This is 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Chrissy Kuiper, and welcome to Pioneers and Engineers, the WUOT story.
This is WUOT, the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Thus officially begins the first university radio station in Tennessee. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Frank Lester, your host for the dedicatory broadcast of WUOT, the new voice testing at 91.9 megacycles. This equipment testing period ended 20 seconds ago, and this is the first produced program on the University of Tennessee FM station.
Tonight, I'm Jack K. Westbrook. My first job with WUOT was as program director and news director. Since I had a degree in journalism, they thought they ought to add that title in there too, I suppose.
This is Ken Wright, and I was director of broadcasting for the university, which included setting up and operating WUOT, the first one.
The Knoxville Journal, the old Knoxville Journal that was on Gay Street downtown, had started an FM station, and it was just simply before its time, that is to say the FM part was.
They weren't making any money with it. It was a commercial station, and they wanted to get rid of it.
And after a few months or a year maybe, they closed up shop.
Subsequently, we decided that the university could buy the transmitter and the equipment and all the related stuff that you have to have for, I think it was $16,000.
$16,000, as I recall.
And, of course, C.E. Brehm was president of the university then and a very far-thinking man. And he said, yes. He said, how many stations are there in the country? And I said, well, as far as I know, there are probably only 20 or 25 university-owned stations. He said, well, let's do it. So we did.
There was no doubt in my mind that once we got on the air, we were going to be on the air.
I don't understand exactly how I could have the temerity to think that it could be done, but I did, and it worked out very well.
My name is Glee Hammer, and I was one of the earliest people at WUOT before it became a truly radio station.
I drew up a program schedule, and we started probably pretty hazy about the hours. There weren't too many. I think we probably started at noon.
Ken would hand me a script. I had a column that was called A Woman Speaks Her Mind. I was the woman who spoke her mind once a week.
We had one on home economics. We don't call that anymore, but it's homemaking.
When it was A Woman Speaks Her Mind, I think it was giving women the right to speak about the things that were going on then, the political things, meaningful things.
But it mostly do with diet and nutrition, you know, things like that. It wasn't making dollies or anything like that.
It definitely wasn't a Betty Crocker how to make bread or something.
Well, the concept I had and which ultimately we used was that this was the voice of the university.
And then sometimes when I was doing the Woman Speaks Her Mind from the University of Tennessee, why, Ken would say, Glee, not so dramatic. Because I did sometimes get a little carried away with the drama.
We wanted to have discussions of things that were important to everybody.
I don't suggest that we were a bunch of stiff shirts, but I think if one sat off at a distance and listened to us for a little while and watched us, you would see that we were committed to quality-type programming.
I must have had some friends in high places because even though this was English department, this was classrooms and offices in the basement of Ayers Hall, but they asked them to leave, and that's where we set it up.
Well, we were in the east end of the basement of Ayers Hall.
The station didn't look like anything. We had to boot out all of the personnel from the basement.
The first tower went on Ayers Hall, and that caused a big confusion because it really didn't look very good.
We'd go over to the basement. There was no other place to go.
Got a lot of flack, by the way, from the folks, particularly in liberal arts, when we put that radio station in Ayers Hall and ran a coaxial cable up the vertical side of the east end of the Ayers Hall across the roof, and our transmitting antenna was a stovepipe-looking thing. Not very attractive.
They would give us dirty looks because they had to move out of the way and let us in to do our broadcast.
And of course, there were radiators in there, steam heat, and then those very small rooms obviously got pretty hot because we couldn't control that. It was central heating, and so that caused us a little problem.
All of us on the staff of WUOT are quite excited about our aims and desires in the area of good music. We hope to please you with our choice of music, both from the Fine Arts Department and our recorded symphonies, each evening from 7:30 until 8:30. It is appropriate that the University a cappella choir sing for this initial broadcast of station WUOT, for this is the first public performance of the newly organized choir.
It is a properest day to sing, Saturday, Sunday, Monday.
Please to be sure, 'tis a mighty fine thing. Why should I name but one day?
One of the things that we did, by the way, in filling manpower for the radio station was to use students. We formed something called the Radio Workshop. I don't recall now how many members we had, but probably 30 or 40 members.
And the students were wonderful. First call in the Beacon, we said we have a radio workshop starting, and I had a room reserved that held about 50 students, and about 300 showed up.
The radio workshop was a very, very effective and very active, and we always had 30, 40 kids in it.
It only worked because of the kind of student body we had. Now, this was 1949, and of course, most of the men, half of them anyway, were veterans, 22, 23 years old.
The war had just gotten over. UT had oh my God, so many returning service people, that my locker was in a Quonset hut across from Ayers Hall because they just had to throw up temporary buildings to make room.
UT was in a state of expanding and trying new things and a great influx. You know, it went from 8,000 students to 16 or 18,000 in just a year or so when the veterans came back.
That was, again, when WUOT was primarily a student operation with just two or three of us who were paid to keep the train on the tracks.
The whole thing was a ferment of activity and imagination, and we fitted into that very well, I think.
Our efforts were not in vain. Not only did we provide a service, but we also were able to provide some experience and assistance to our young people who were interested in broadcasting.
Well, when you get 18 to 25-year-olds together, anything that they're interested in, there's bound to be a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm, and there was. The students, they hung around all day. In between classes, they came to the studio, and they sometimes came to my office if I wasn't busy. We'd sit down and talk about things.
And I think the point is we were somewhat of a pioneer, I guess you would say, in educational broadcasting. I would not suggest that we were the first, but we were certainly among the early stations.
We were among the pioneers who went before and sort of blazed the trail for what came afterwards.
It's kind of the magic of it, that here we were doing, we're using a modern technique of communication to reach people with information and good music, cultural things, reading poetry sometimes and things like that on the air. That was a little bit of cut above what you would normally do.
Thank you. University of Tennessee is the state university. The university belongs to the people of Tennessee, and it is devoted to serve not only students in residence in the university classroom, but all groups and segments of society, youth and adults, throughout the entire state, through research.
My name is Herb Howard. I came to the University of Tennessee in 1959 as a producer for the Tape Network.
My name is Raymond Shirley. I was hired as the chief engineer for WOT and stuck around until I ended up as the director of the station.
The Tape Network was simply a group of stations across the state that would receive mailings of audio taped radio programs.
We put programs on some sort of device to send to radio stations across the state.
Once tape recorders came in, I drove all around the state, visited every radio station, and I said, here's a program you can have free.
We got out and drove the state, calling on radio stations to take our 15-minute programs and broadcast them.
So I wound up with 200 or 300 programs a week on tape.
Now I can tell you many horror stories about the Tape Network.
They would broadcast those tapes to their local audience.
We were recording programs on acetate disc with a disc cutter, and a chip would hang up on the cutting stylus, and you'd lose the whole disc. Right toward the end, you'd lose the whole disc, and you'd have to start over.
And then we had the journalism department produce with us a weekly news show, Three-Star Report, I called it.
Some of the faculty members who were interviewed frequently on the Tape Network really became celebrities in their own way.
Well, the mission of the station was to communicate to the public that the University of Tennessee had some interest in beauty and in good taste and that sort of thing, and that's what we tried to suggest in our programming and in our broadcasting.
The Tape Network was referred to as the campus of the air. That was the idea, to take the campus to the people wherever they were in the state.
And just the evolution of broadcasting and the development of the cable networks and satellite communication, due to that, the Tape Network just sort of faded into the background, disappeared.
I'm George DeVault, and my association with WUOT was as a student working there in 1964, 65, and 66.
My name is Ashley Capps, and I hosted radio shows on WUOT for 31 years, from 1973 to 2004.
My name is Norris Dreyer, and I worked at WUOT in several different capacities over the years, in production, music director, program director.
When I began working there, I worked a couple of nights a week, and I can't recall the gentleman who came in, but he came in and did the jazz concert. It ran from 11 to midnight. One night, for some reason, he couldn't make it. He asked me if I would do the show, and I did it, and so then I began to do it.
I believe my first show was in March of my senior high school year.
And I knew about the station. I knew it was a fine arts station. It was basically a classical music station. There were no live programs on the station at all except the jazz concert.
You know, I could come and play my favorite music on the radio, and there were people out there that were listening to it. So that was great.
Basically, the station was run by students as far as physically, mechanically doing all the things that had to be done. And all of the introductions for the classical music programs were pre-recorded. This was good because most students didn't know how to pronounce the names of the composers.
We would employ them and pay them minimum wage to work for the station.
The minimum wage, I think, had advanced to about $1.10 or $15, but they paid us a dollar.
It was bare minimum.
Practically all of the music was played on LPs. And I remember with great embarrassment, one night I was talking to my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and the other line was ringing. And I said, wait a minute, I'm getting another call. And it was a fellow in Abingdon, Virginia, who was listening to WUOT. And he said, I don't know whether you've noticed it or not, but your record is stuck. And he says, it's been stuck for about 5 minutes.
Most of the students were dependable, and you could rely on them. Once in a while, while you'd get one who was a sleepyhead. I'd be at home listening. Of course, I'd monitor the station, and a record would be playing, and it would reach the end, and it would just keep going, clickety-click, and I'd know that the student had gone to sleep.
Since my boyfriend's gone away, I keep watching every day for the mailman.
I remember playing, I think it was Anita O'Day with Stan Kenton's orchestra, which would now be considered jazz. There's no question about that. And I think it may have been Ray Shirley who called me up and he said, you know, that's a little like pop music. I don't know whether we want to play that or not.
I can think of two or three specific incidences where the student tried to step outside the boundaries of our programming and put some stuff on that didn't belong on the station, was not consistent with what we were trying to achieve.
There are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7.
For example, I had been on vacation over South Carolina to visit my mother. I was on my way back driving through the mountains listening to the station, and one of the employees started playing Carlin's 7 forbidden words on the air. That created quite a stir. I called the engineer at that time and said, shut the transmitter down until I got there.
And the station signed off at midnight. And so most of the students had keys to Ayers Hall, but we would actually go in and out the window of the control room.
The easiest access to the station was actually through some large windows at ground level on the east side of the building. And we tended to come and go often, particularly the later night shifts, through the windows rather than go up the stairs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. The windows at Ayers Hall.
Pizza was delivered through the windows there, and there was a place on the strip that delivered chicken, and those came in through the windows, too.
And students would come by there who also worked there during hours when they weren't working, because it was a quiet place to study. And occasionally, you'd hear a knock on the window.
In fact, I got duct tape and taped up around the seams of the windows to try to shut it out, and the students would take the duct tape off and help, because that was a shortcut. They didn't have to go up and down the stairs to get out of the basement.
At that time, students basically worked weekend and night shifts.
And then several times I've walked in unannounced after office hours and found the student having a party in the control room.
But we went in and out the windows, and we played the LPs, and they did occasionally get stuck.
About early 1956, they moved the transmitter out to John Tarleton Hill to a metal building and used some surplus equipment they'd gotten from Oak Ridge from the Manhattan Project.
And of course, Ray Shirley was the chief engineer in those days, and through the years, that transmitter operated at John Tarleton Hill, but he did a lot of modifications to it, and he was rather proud of those. And he had acquired some parts from Oak Ridge.
I often wondered how much radiation I got out of working in that building.
So one day, being interested in things like that, I went up to the transmitter with him.
The building was not tight enough to keep out animals, and so snakes and mice would get in and short out power supply, and I would be called out at 9 or 10 o'clock at night to come in to get the power supply back on.
And Ray wore, and still does wear, very thick glasses. At least to me they seemed thick. And we went into the transmitter, and he's turning these dials and pushing these spring-loaded switches, and you can see through the glass window on the front of the transmitter, these big coils turning and so forth.
It required a lot of manipulation to adjust the tuning and get the tuning and the load balanced just right to where the thing would stabilize and operate properly.
And you could feel the warmth of the big tubes and the glow of the tube. And I remember he was smiling and he was adjusting, and I had my nose practically on the window there, feeling the warmth of the tube.
It used four 1000A tubes. They lit up cherry red when you fired up the transmitter.
And I looked around at Ray, and you could see the glow of the tube reflecting off the front of his glasses, and I thought, my, I'm with the mad scientist here.
Well, I don't know if I got mad sometimes.
He loved that transmitter, and he did so many things to it. It was amazing.
So the transmitter was a little cantankerous, and I spent many an hour working with that thing, keep it balanced and loaded properly.
The Last Words of David by Randall Thompson, performed by the Knoxville Symphony Orchestra and the University of Tennessee Singers.
When I first came here, for several years, we did live broadcasts from the UT Music Hall, recitals by the music faculty and band and orchestra concerts and all. And we had an announce booth in the balcony of the UT Music Hall. And after a concert was over, Bill Scarlett, very, very well-known classical and more lately jazz performer on UT clarinet, he's about 85 years old, he came up into the balcony area and was talking very loudly outside the announce booth as I was closing out the broadcast. Well, I pushed the cough button, opened the door, and I said, "Bill, damn it, I'm still on the air. Please be quiet." The broadcast was over, and I went over to the engineer's studio and had his head down on his desk and his arm. And I said, "What's wrong, Bill?" And he said, "I forgot to tell you, Norris, the cough button doesn't work."
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
I was station director during the 60s when there was a lot of demonstration on campus because of the Vietnam War and also civil rights.
The students were resistant to UOT partially because we didn't hire many broadcasting students. We didn't think a 100,000-watt station was appropriate as a lab experience to train broadcasters.
The students became very upset with me because I was resisting their desire to turn the station into a rock station. They wanted to put rock music on and make it a rock station.
And they were legitimately concerned that the university's public radio station really didn't offer musical programming that appealed to most of them.
I was not going along with that, so I received several threatening phone calls, threatening me personally and also threatening to burn the station.
Their argument was that since they, and more likely their parents' taxpayers' money, was helping to support the station, that we ought to be playing some music that they wanted to listen to.
I tried to strike a balance between giving the students some of the airtime that they could program what they wanted and within reason, within bounds, but at the same time maintain the basic character of the station as a fine arts station.
So we decided that we would add a program called Till 2. At that time, we had signed off at 12 midnight, but we allowed students to come in and host that program, and that worked out pretty well.
I usually ended up sticking the students on at 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that.
And when WUTK went on the air, of course, all pressure was off UOT anymore to do rock programming, and so we ceded it to UTK.
A lot of emotion and hot tempers around the campus during that period of time.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
At that time, if right-wing speakers were invited, they came, and left-wing speakers were essentially nixed by the administration. And we were told that we could not program things that Martin Luther King was involved in.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
I must say that I had great support from the university administration. There were several times I got in hot water because of things that were program.
I was able to find recordings of these left-wingers giving talks at other universities. We played them on UOT late at night. The president of the university never listened to us then. People who would be opposed, I don't know, but we accomplished that.
President Bowling, he gave me a lot of leeway, and he backed me several times. There were times when he could have just said, you make these changes or else you establish a censor board, but he didn't. He let me put the noose around my neck as long as I wanted. I'll have to say that his wife was a loyal listener, and she was on my side. I appreciate Ms. Bowling.
We were sort of proud of being kind of an underground, beneath-the-radar spokespersons for those that wanted more equitable radio programming.
You're listening to Pioneers and Engineers, a look back at 60 years of radio on WUOT.
There was discussion, beginning, I guess, in the mid-60s, of a new building that would house all things related to communications, and that would include WUOT.
We worked on the plans for this building.
In June of 69, we moved to the brand-new communications building, which was wonderful from a space standpoint.
That's the move to Circle Park, where the station is still located.
But it was so much more space than we had had, and a new building, so it was an exciting time to get out of the basement of Ayers Hall.
With that building, WUOT was able to improve its studios and control facilities and offices into a very modern broadcasting operation.
Of course, moving a radio station is quite a project. Even at that time, I think we had about 7,000 records. Moving them and trying to keep them in order, whatever.
We ran out of space. We had even taken over one of the storage closets out in the hallway in the basement.
In fact, the record library initially was only half full of records, where in the old place they were piled on the floor.
There were several recommendations I made which were ignored, and so we had a problem after we moved in making the studios usable because the reverberation and echo was so terrible.
And of course we had all new state-of-the-art equipment which we had to learn to use.
It was a challenge, a lot of exciting things.
The musty smell of Ayers Hall was replaced by the new smell that any new building has, which was very, very nice. It was quite a challenge, but it was an exciting time.
My name is Brett Ward, and my earliest recollections of WUOT occurred in about 1963. In 62, I was in second grade, and my family moved from Paducah, Kentucky, where we had lived the classic Ozzie and Harriet lifestyle. And very shortly after that, we moved to Loudoun County and began living in a house on my grandparents' farm. It was at that point in time my father traded our only TV set for an FM radio. At the time, I didn't understand what FM radio was, but he tuned the radio to WUOT and basically threatened anyone who would change the dial. If he had thought about it, I'm sure he would have pulled the knobs off so that nobody could touch it. But at that point in time, his definition of music was classical music was good music and everything else was not. But ever since then, you know, I've always known that if you wanted classical music, WUOT was the place to go.
I think the earliest successes in listenership on WUOT probably were related to classical music.
And other than the couple of hours a week of the jazz concert, it was all classical music.
I'm Daniel Berry, and I'm the program director at WUOT. And I don't go around thinking highfalutin thoughts most of the time.
I don't recall ever any discussion of should we play popular music.
It was a very serious station. You knew that unless they were music majors, the students weren't listening to the station. It wasn't designed to be a student station.
We didn't really program to the students in those days. That part of the original goal kind of went by the wayside.
First of all, there is nothing magic about classical music. It is not something that's up on a pedestal that you as a mere mortal can not possibly understand if you haven't gone to school.
Now, there were students who liked classical music and would listen, but as you know, that's not popular music.
Which is music of the people, and it tends to come and go. Nobody plays Sophie Tucker on the air much anymore, or Al Jolson. But they will play composers like Samuel Barber, people like that who came from sort of the same generation.
And WUOT was the only station that engaged in classical music, so it made its name in the classical realm.
The general trick that I've learned over the years is that if you're going to say something about a piece of music, find one thing that will catch their attention.
As far as music was concerned, classical music, I think, was the backbone of WUOT for many years.
There are some pieces you just can't do much with, like a violin concerto by Vivaldi. He must have written 40 of them, and they all sound the same.
I think it's a shame, for one thing, that it becomes a battle between different musical forms. I mean, no one should have to defend classical music. No one should have to defend opera. Their power as art forms speak for themselves.
I have no arguments with people who like various other musical forms as well. But there has to be some place where that music, just like that literature, that theater, should be available for people to discover.
WUOT's role as an outlet for great classical music and great opera is unquestionable.
I hear fairly frequently from people who want us to carry a different kind of music or a different kind of programming. And I have to explain classical music to them. It is the musical culture of Western civilization.
I do believe in the mission of public radio and that mission should transcend the demands of the marketplace.
To me, a radio station like this serves the same purpose as an art museum does, or as a repertory theater like the Clarence Brown, or even the public library.
You know, one of those constants in life of grandma's apple pie, going home for Christmas, and classical music was at WUOT.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Robert Conley with All Things Considered.
It was educational radio in those days. It was public radio had not even been talked about.
We were part of educational radio at the time that I joined the staff. And that continued until National Public Radio was formed in Denver, Colorado, after the Public Broadcasting Act was passed.
But it was the foundation for what ultimately became public radio in the late 1960s, I think.
There was some reluctance at first in taking on the identity of a public radio station as opposed to an educational radio station licensed to a university. One of the things that was a point of contention was losing individual station personal control over their programming. And another was changing the content of the programming as this new organization evolved.
We were a charter member of NPR. We carried the very first All Things Considered.
Thousands of young people came to Washington willing to risk being arrested in order to end the war. They went into the streets this morning to stop the government from functioning by clogging many Washington roads during this morning's rush hour. For many demonstrators, the mobile street tactics of civil disobedience are an expected spring event. But before today, many other young people who came to Washington had not been willing to oppose the state with their bodies. For these young Americans, today was a major test of their commitment to the ethical code of the young and the angry. It was their Freedom Ride, their Selma March, their May Day.
One of the first programs that National Public Radio developed was All Things Considered, and they wanted all of the stations to agree to carry that at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
And it caused some issues at the beginning because we had always had kind of light classical. In fact, we called it dinner music. In the old days, before I came, it was called Candlelight and Silver.
For years, we had put on dinner music, you know, light classical music for the dinner hour at 5 and 6 in the afternoon.
And so, people who were used to listening to light classical music during their dinner hour were quite offended by All Things Considered. Not that it wasn't a fine program even from the start, but just that they wanted music instead of talk.
And here come the police. 1, 2, 3, 4 police on motor scooters. One demonstrator knocked down by a motor scooter policeman.
The first broadcast of All Things Considered, when we broke away and joined the network to carry All Things Considered, you would have thought I had desecrated the station forever. The phone lit up and people were very unhappy because I had taken away their dinner music.
And then later on, Morning Edition came on. We had the same problem. And after several years of resisting it, I resisted it. People were used to waking up to music, and the main complaint was, now I have to wake up and face the problems of the world instead of starting my day more serenely.
Programming consisted about 80-85% music and 10-15% talk. The ratio, it became obvious right away that that NPR expected the ratio to change, and so some of us were a little bit stubborn about it.
It wasn't an aversion to news, just the transition of changing the station's philosophy.
I thought of WOT as a fine arts station rather than a talk radio station.
And so when the station and when public radio in general became more news-oriented and less music-oriented, I was resistant because it was moving in a direction different from what I had been brought up in public radio and different from the reason I wanted to be in public radio.
I can see that there's need and place for both the fine arts aspect and the talk.
We weathered that storm and, of course, eventually garnered a larger audience.
We toughed it out and stuck with it, and we gradually won them over, and they began to realize that this was a valuable addition to the programming. I was reluctant to get into the news field because I felt like we had several stations who had multiple news personnel who were out in the field researching and developing stories, and we were not going to compare very favorably to what they were doing if we started a news program. So that's the reason I was slow about getting into the news area.
Now, for a long, long time, we did not have newscasts.
We had no local news or local public affairs programmers. Other public radio stations around the country were adding public affairs and news people, personnel on the staff. And I could see that we were not in step with the movement nationwide among public radio stations. The first person I employed was a public affairs director, and she would put together programs dealing with things in the community, in the local area that needed to be aired.
And we hired mid-70s, I guess, probably late 70s, hired a news director.
I'm Regina Dean, and I am the director and general manager of WUOT Public Radio.
My name is Matt Schaefer-Powell, and I'm the news director at WUOT.
Unfortunately, when we first attempted to try and insert local programming into All Things Considered and Morning Edition, we didn't do it well.
WUOT had had a local news department from time to time, but it came in fits and starts, and nothing really seemed to work.
One of the dreams that I had and one of the visions that I saw walking in to station in this size market and this size of a staff, that we should be able to be doing quality NPR news broadcast on a local and regional level.
So when I was brought here, I was hired to start a local news operation here, and it was a great opportunity for me because I got to start it from ground zero.
I came in 1995. You know, it was on my top list of things to do. Let's get some local news going here.
This is All Things Considered on WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell. The neon marquee on Knoxville's Fifth Avenue Motel looks like something from a 1950s postcard, offering such temptations as air conditioning, TV, and tile baths. But for the last 20 years or so, that marquee at the corner of 5th and Broadway has done little but illuminate the dark side of urban life on the sidewalk below.
The first feature story I did at WUOT had to do with the 5th Avenue Motel. They had just closed, the city had just closed down the 5th Avenue Motel. It was in terrible shape, and it was really kind of a neat reminder of days past. And I did this story in the 5th Avenue Motel, and we ran it on the air here. And because listeners weren't used to the idea of having somebody locally doing these kinds of stories, a lot of people thought this was on NPR, that NPR had sent a reporter to Knoxville to do this story on the Fifth Avenue Motel. And I think a lot of, you know, for some people, it was like, hey, wow, you know, we've hit the big time. And then they found out, no, this was the local reporter, the new local reporter at WUOT. And honestly, I think a few people were a little bit disappointed.
I wanted to be able to bring news of a network quality, but with the limited resources you have, you can't do all of it. And we decided that we would do what we could in terms of doing longer form pieces and leaving the breaking news to other media.
These days we have so many places we can get news. We have access to so many different media. So what we do has to be special. It has to be different. And I think we can do that by really going for the human face behind the news. Not just the story, but who does it affect? How does it affect them? And really put a face to these stories and these issues and these topics.
What we do is to be able to tell stories in a compelling way to see the human side of the story. And I think the awards that our news department has won over the last few years has shown that we've been able to do that.
I think those are the stories our listeners expect from us, and those are the stories that we enjoy providing for them.
You know, we're trying to help as many and serve as many people as we can.
I did a series a few years ago called Lost to War, where I interviewed people who had known somebody who died in battle, not just the most recent wars, but we went as far back as World War II. And I interviewed this guy who was who had been a soldier in Vietnam, and he talked to me about his buddy in Vietnam who had been killed. And his buddy's name was Ray Rentz.
Raymond was a solid soldier in every dimension. He was friendly. He was always smiling. He never said anything disparaging.
We ran the story on the air, and we put it on our website, and, you know, it was probably at least a year later. I get this phone call from this guy in Detroit, Michigan. He said, "You're not going to believe this, but I'm sitting next to Ray Rentz Jr., the guy you did the story on. I'm sitting next to his son." From that point, I was contacted by others of Ray's relatives, and it made me really appreciate the power of what we do, because it brought these people back together, people who hadn't spoken about Ray's death in years and years and years.
Most of us, our lifestyle is such, we don't have time to be experts on everything. We don't have time to really dig for the truth all the time. I think public radio in particular has taken on that role because there's nobody else to do it anymore.
We've had programs developed over time that have added a great deal to the educational and informational value of the station.
I think that public broadcasting has a tradition and has a mission and has a passion for being able to give different viewpoints with the ability to have civil discourse.
We're all here because we love public radio, not because anybody wants to get rich or anything like that. We're here because we love public radio. We believe in the mission of public radio. And that's something all of us share. As you go from one end of the radio station and walk down to the other, every office you pass, every person you pass is going to have that kind of passion.
we thought that what we were doing was something that any person would be interested in. And I think they were, eventually. But it took a little time. You understand, we had a pretty small audience at first. I don't know how many. I would guess several thousand, maybe.
Interesting, we had a great audience in Oak Ridge. Okay, but we had a pretty good audience, I think, considering.
These were people that were, you know, fairly well educated and sort of in tune with the fact that there are other things besides the lower levels.
Well, I think it's because generally it's a very highly educated population, and in general we would expect our listenership to be among the well-educated whose taste rose above pop music and country music and that sort of thing.
Well, I think public broadcasting encompasses programming for all segments of society, as opposed to, let's face it, an elite audience that preferred classical music.
There is no typical WOT listener, but it makes it really hard to come up with a snappy slogan.
I suppose that a fair number of them are housewives. There are people driving around town running errands.
NPR for East Tennessee, I tried that one time, and that didn't go very far.
There are a fair number of people in their offices who have us on in the background.
You know, intelligent radio, we like to think of that, because whether you're a news or a music listener, you want more than just, you know, passive listening.
There are retired people who are just keeping us on as their companions, hour in and hour out. All those people, I guess.
So it does make it difficult to say, you know, who and what we are, but I do think that's probably part of the charm of public radio.
I think it's definitely people who have a much more active, engaged interest in the world than perhaps your average person, more curious, wanting to delve more deeply, whether it's into the news issues or into music.
The listeners truly are and understand their partners.
Really, since the advent of television, experts have been predicting the demise of radio. I always find that an interesting discussion because radio has survived, and I think it'll continue to survive. And it hasn't survived just by happenstance. It survived because smart, creative people have helped move it in different directions.
Who can predict what we're going to have in the way of communication and exchange of ideas in the next 10, 15 years?
I think this is a really exciting time because radio is in the middle of an evolution, and I think WUOT is going to be right there in the middle of that evolution. We're going to be incorporating different media into what we do so that, you know, the radio station of the future, the WUOT of the future, is not going to just be a spot on the radio dial. There'll be a lot of different places that you'll be able to find the content that we're providing.
I hope WOT has a place and that it finds a niche and that it can continue to provide a viable and worthwhile service. That would be my hope because I've invested too many years in the station.
I have no reason to think the station won't continue to be a very important part of our community.
There's such a smorgasbord of choices out there for the public. It's hard for me to envision what is going to be the future, how the station must evolve in order to maintain a viable and important role in the community and in the university.
And what we do every day is important to so many people in so many different ways.
We get the opportunity when we have like a 60th anniversary like this, I think we have the opportunity to sort of look back and examine, you know, what do we mean to the community and how important is it? And I think, honestly, the answer isn't one single grand response. I think every single day this radio station means something important to somebody in this community.
What I love about WOT and what I love about what I do is that I do think it has a positive influence and impact on the community.
I'm Jim Slice. I'm a longtime listener of WUOT.
We've heard stories of people who brought their kids up. They took their kids to school every day listening to Morning Edition, and now their kids are taking their kids listening to Morning Edition.
I love radio so much. I was raised with radio.
Now, when I don't have a radio that I carry out in the field, but I'm thinking about getting one because I hate to go out and do work without being able to listen to the radio.
I can see what's going on in my mind's eye, and that mind theater is so strong, I think, in the people who were raised with radio.
Sometimes in the middle of the night, I'll be tuned to WUOT to listen to whatever the program is.
What is that wonderful Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on Saturday? That's a lot of fun. I love that. And, of course, Prairie Home Companion. If I miss it Saturday, I always get it Sunday afternoon. Thank you so much for repeating it. I appreciate that.
Sometimes I regret getting where I'm going because I have to detach myself from the radio.
I still think that what gives public radio its potential power and sets it apart from everything else is that uniqueness. There's no place else you can hear Car Talk or This American Life or Prairie Home Companion.
I prefer the music and the fine art, but there's some of the talk that I would miss, you know, Prairie Home Companion and the guys with the automobile shop. And, of course, all things considered, those are things that I think have great value.
Matter of fact, I've sat there in the car as late as yesterday listening to programming that I felt like I could stay and listen. I sometimes sit in the car and listen to the radio because I found the programming so interesting.
I'm a great fan of WUOT and what it does, what it stands for.
I don't really mean to be proud, but I'm most delighted with the fact that I was able to go over there and to pull off the business of buying a defunct radio station from a newspaper and having it hauled over there, and then with students as entire staff, and to get this all on the air within a matter of 3 or 4 months, that is something that I certainly do feel proud of.
I feel like it was a rewarding time. I felt like I was involved in something that was meeting a need and providing a service to a community at large that they could not get anywhere else.
That's really been exciting, particularly our 60th anniversary year, to be able to say, hey, you know, we're still here, we're still doing what you've expected us to do all this time, but look, we can serve you with even more.
I recall WUOT with a great deal of fondness.
It was so much fun.
WUOT has a real place in my heart. I've only been here about little over seven years, but it's been a great experience for me. It's a great place to work. We have a really nice family culture here.
I can't think of any place that I would want to be except right here. And, you know, as you get older, those things get to be more important. So, yeah, this is a great place, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
The best compliment I guess I could give to the station is I never a single time minded going there to work, and I consider myself very, very lucky, and it's to the credit of the university and the vast majority of my colleagues over the years that I enjoyed my career so much.
They have class. That's what it is. They have class. And class is so hard to find anymore.
And Engineers, the WUOT story, was produced and edited by Leslie Snow. The executive producer was Matt Schaefer Powell. The first broadcast of All Things Considered was brought to you courtesy of NPR. Special thanks to Ken Wright, Jack Westbrook, Glee Hammer, Herb Howard, George DeVault, Ashley Capps, Norris Dreyer, Raymond Shirley, Brett Ward, Daniel Barry, Regina Dean, and Jim Slice. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Thank you for joining us today for this special presentation, Pioneers and Engineers, the WUOT Story.